One is a prominent entry in the surprisingly robust genre of 90s sci-fi action comedy. The other is its long overdue sequel slash remake with a bit more of a spy agency than, you know, directly whatever the hell they're meant to be in the first movie. Men in Black. They remade it. And welcome back to another episode of They Remade It. I'm your host, Stuart.
And I'm your host, Jacob.
And I won't even beat around the bush this time around. Dear God, what is the weather doing? It is killing my sinuses. So if I sound dribbly or I start sneezing uncontrollably, that's why. It's, oh dear God, it's been awful.
Yep, it was 80 here just 2 days ago, and today it's 40. So I'm in a similar boat of what is going on. And well, I always have sinus and allergy issues, so that's not a big thing.
Not fair. It's been going in waves for whatever reason, where it's like, oh, it got really, really cold for like a solid week, and it got really warm for a solid week. Now it's getting cold again, and it's going to keep doing that, it looks like. I'm so tired. I just want fall. Just yeah. Let me have this, oh. Damn you.
It never gets any better. Sorry to say.
I know.
The way things go, but I mean, to that end, what have you been doing recently to try and keep your mind off of it?
Oh, it's actually a surprising amount compared to normal. We had a bit of a delay in this recording, so I've had just a bit of extra time to do more stuff. But prior to this, I had been not doing a ton of extra. First and foremost, though, was I got Baldur's Gate 3 finally, and that has been my predominant addiction. It's pretty damn good. I have some issues, personally. I think I'm personally not very good at turn-based combat. I'm especially bad, in the case of Baldur's Gate being D&D, basically. I'm especially bad playing magic characters. And the problem with Baldur's Gate is that you're required to play, you know, lots of different classes of characters instead of just, you know, in typical D&D fashion, you just play one. So I'm just in this constant situation of, am I doing okay or am I basically just cheesing this? Which then I remember that it's D&D and 90% of the time it's cheesing it, so I don't care. I will say, of all the hype I've gotten about it, I was not told about the amount of glitches I would run into, because more than just, like, you know, obviously, you know, again, it can be expected with D&D that, yeah, shit's going to go wrong. But on a technical level, there is just so much able to go on that I can't tell you how many times I've just had situations where critical quest NPCs just, like, don't function. You know, I had to basically reload a good 5 to 8 hours of gameplay to roll back and get a quest that just wouldn't activate in the second act. And it affected quite a bit going forward in the story. Like, it's not a mainline mission. It's still just a side mission. But it's still did a bunch of shit with that. So I had to go back with that because it just didn't activate for me for one at one point. Another point in the part where I'm at right now, it happened again where I meant to follow one NPC as they go to another part of a building, but they just wouldn't move. And so I literally had to, like, I had to look up how someone had scummed it. And they literally have to pickpocket the character, wait for them to start looking for the thief, make them chase after you, and then run to the spot where they actually continue their dialogue, and then hopefully it'll work there. And I managed to do that after, like, 10 tries. So
yeah, because it's of how dynamic the game is, they're still finding right. A lot of those. I know there was one that they just patched like a week or two ago where a critical quest-giving NPC wouldn't give you the quest if you finished a particular side mission before talking to him. And it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, you're just locked out of it, and since it's story-based, the game stops here. And I think they only just took care of that. So they're still squashing a lot of that, and it's just based on the level of interactivity that's there.
Yeah. I'm guessing you've played it as well.
But I've played a little bit of it, but I actually stopped playing it because a couple of friends, some of which you know, not all of them, but also they also got the game and were planning on playing it soon. So I was like, okay, I'm just gonna stop here, and you know, just engage with it from a multiplayer aspect.
I mean, I'm down to go sometime if y'all want an extra jackass running around. I'm guessing you have sure. A full party at this point.
We'll definitely look. As of right now, I think we have a full party, but that could change. Fine. So
I assure you, I am posted. I assure you, I am no expert at this game. I play monk for a reason. That being, I like the very light magic, and then just getting to punch people a bunch, and then not getting hit at all. Just being able to, I gotta say, I save scum like a bastard. Like, I have zero shame in this game. There's so many moments where it's like, oh, okay, I have all these bonuses and everything, and I need to do this so I don't get my ass completely wiped off the map. And it's a natural one. Okay, fuck you. I have always wanted to do that in normal D&D, and God willing, and God is my witness, I do not care that I do it in this. I will do another run at some point where I don't do that. I promise.
I mean, the game, that's the good thing, that's the cool thing about that type of game, you know, fits every style of gameplay, even from, I mean, even down to a functional level like that. Something as simple as, I don't like my role, I don't like RNG.
Yeah, at a certain point, it's just annoying. But yeah, that's been predominantly what I've been doing with spare time. On the more, you know, actual, like, movie and show side, my girlfriend has started getting back into Grey's Anatomy, which means I have gotten kind of the secondhand and also direct firsthand experience of watching that show from the beginning. My God, I get what people talk, why people talk about that show now. It's not that it's, not in the sense that it's like, oh, it's so good. It's pretty okay. It's just that the characters in it are psychopaths. Like, it is obscene. Like, people talk about, like, you know, there's the show House, where it goes on and on about the main character basically committing medical malpractice on a regular basis, which I'd honestly argue, at a certain point, he's doing all of those things to help his patients who have insane diseases that no one's been able to figure out before. And I gotta tell you, if I had a doctor willing to go above and beyond like he did, I wouldn't care. I wouldn't sue him. Meanwhile, the people in Grey's Anatomy are just, like, fucking up diagnoses and deliberately, like, putting people into bad situations out of, like, jealousy or spite and all these different things. I'm like, you people all need to be put into a home because you are, you need to be locked up the rest of your lives. You guys are out of your minds if you guys think this is okay.
I've never really watched Grey's Anatomy, but I've always been surprised that people like it, because when I hear folks talk about it, it always sounds like they're going for, like, a Seinfeld or It's Always Sunny style show, but you're supposed to like the characters instead of hate them.
Yeah, so, and that's the thing.
I don't know how anyone could enjoy that.
It's, imagine if Seinfeld was about another 100% about more sex, except they couldn't use the word fuck. And so it's basically talking around it and showing around it as much as humanly possible. And yeah, all the characters are still just terrible people, and you're meant to root for them in many cases. Most recently, the plotline we had was this one girl was in love with this one patient who was there consistently, who had, like, a heart issue. He was looking to get, like, a new heart, but he kept, like, every time a new one would come up for donation, he would, like, lose it for whatever reason. Like, he wouldn't be the one to receive it. And it got to a point where the girl who fell in love with him, one of the doctor characters, straight up deliberately makes him go into, like, cardiac arrest, essentially, in order to move up his, like, basically his criticality level to be able to be more eligible for a heart. That was, like, you know, recently made available. And yeah, like, that alone is horrible, because it's like this doctor is directly committing medical malpractice because he's fallen for this guy. And of course, the guy's also into her, so he's cool with it for some goddamn reason. But then all of her coworkers decide to help her and, like, to help hide it and try to take the blame. And then in the end, spoiler alert, he dies anyway. Like, he dies of a separate thing.
I like the fact that it's separate. It's an unrelated thing.
Like, ultimately, like, yeah, he gets the heart and he's totally fine. But then it turns out, oh, he had a blood clot and he died of a stroke inside, like, 10 seconds. Like, it's completely, like, and I know the whole thing was meant to build up to that, and it's like, okay, yeah, she can't just get away with this, but she's totally gonna get away with it because her character's gonna stay on for several seasons. Where it's like, in any rational world, they would bury her alive for this. Like, it's just stuff like that where it kind of, it's at times it straddles the line where it's like, okay, these people are doing really dumb, irrational decisions, but also they're very human decisions. And then there's moments like this where it's like, you guys are psychopaths, and you need to be nowhere near a clinic, let alone a hospital.
It's just a hospital full of a bunch of Dr. Nicks running around committing atrocities.
And basically, if not committing atrocities, at least being just the most sassy, spiteful pieces of shit in the world, and, like, having airing out their dirty laundry in front of the people they're trying to be, like, you know, medically saving. It's a lot.
Well, it sounds like you're enjoying that.
It's a beautiful train wreck of a show. I love it. it's so wild just being like, it's like the Tiger King, but consistent. it's like, no, I don't like anyone here, and that makes me feel great. But that's been the TV side of things. And then on the movie, proper movie side of things, Hannah and I have actually made a very exhaustive list of all the movies I think she needs to see. And so we've decided to start going through that. It ranges wildly. We just got it from a few different lists online. But the one we started off the list was with the one we started off the list was The Fifth Element, of all things.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which, you know, pertinent for today, but we'll get to that. Yeah, like we did, had a big list. A lot, like the list contains, you know, pretty much everything from any kind of genre. Quite a few heavier ones, just because like that's some of the, you know, better rated and better received films out there. So I decided, you know, let's go with an easy one and one that actually did quite a lot to define my love of early love of sci-fi. And yeah, I still adore it. It's silly and it's borderline fantasy film because the whole crux of the film is the literal physical embodiment of evil is physically manifested in the universe and is now coming to destroy all life because it is bad and life is good. And the whole thing, it comes to a head with the fact that the fifth element in question of, alongside, you know, the earth, wind, water, and fire, the fifth element is love. So it's like, yeah, we defeat evil with the power of love, but also lots of cool, like, aesthetic sci-fi things and really, really good environmental storytelling and, like, detail driving and that sort of thing. I absolutely love this movie. It's so fun. Just, like, just finding the little details to kind of just be interested in, you know, just, like, the fact that in this world, shrinkflation has affected even, like, basically everything, including cigarettes. So cigarettes are, like, 75% filter and 25% actual cigarettes. And just, like, little things like that. Just, you know, whenever you look around, it's like, oh, that's a fun thing they decided to add. And it's just kind of that mark of a bygone era of set design and movie design where people gave a shit about it. It's fun to watch back through it and just like all the hokey acting and everything. Like my God, fucking Chris Tucker as the really like, the fact that there is a sci-fi future radio host because radio is still prevalent in the year, I think 2500 or whatever. Or I think it's like 2400, 2200, maybe. I don't know, whatever. It's just the fact that radio is still such a prominent thing that there's this like just nouveau radio host that's able to do all this crazy shit and just Chris Tucker just being absolutely buck wild in it. And you know, Bruce Willis actually being a pretty decent heartthrob in a movie, which is not really what you expect from Bruce Willis of all people. But yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. Probably explains a lot about me considering how early I saw that film and how much TNA there is in it, quite frankly.
Right. Well, I'm glad you liked the movie. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember liking it just fine. And I'm glad that you're sort of doing like an activity, like, you know, these are what, you know, needs to be seen and sort of going through that. That's always a fun exercise. Next time, I'm sure you'll be watching something more thought-provoking, like The Conversation.
I was going to maybe do that, like, fucking, I don't know, maybe Shawshank.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm doing the big hits first before we start getting into the nitty-gritties.
Okay.
Yeah. Which, to be fair, I guess
let
Shawshank
me know when you need is...
Whenever we start going down the list, I pretty much consistently, I pretty much like a blanket went, I don't know how you're going to feel about David Lynch. So I know your tastes and I don't know if David Lynch is a taste. I'm pretty sure that's like the movie equivalent of being lightly smacked in the face with a fish. Not in a bad way necessarily, but not necessarily. Exactly. There we go. Yeah, we're going to be going through that more. Probably try to do, you know, one every few days. Just, you know, try to go to, we got a pretty long list to go through now, so.
I will
say outright, I only have one Mafia movie on there, and no, it's not The Godfather. I am fully of the mind, you don't have to see The Godfather.
Oh, I'm sure it's The Sting.
It actually isn't.
A con movie.
We do have a few crime movies, because there's so many. But the only Mafia movie I believe we have on there is Goodfellas.
Oh, well, I mean, that's a hell of a one to have, so.
Oh yeah, because like I still consider it to be one of the more accurate, you know, mob movies at the end of the day.
Yep, that was my first DVD purchase.
Ooh, cool.
First thing I ever bought for myself.
I think it's the only Scorsese movie I have on there as well. Yeah, I think it actually is. The Raging Bull might be on there, but I'm not sure.
Oh, you got to get After Hours on that list.
Yeah, I probably got to do that. Also, maybe Gangs of New York, but that was a bit more of a comparatively lighthearted one.
King of Comedy? Not into your list, so.
I mean, I don't know. Fucking, I don't know. I'll need to go look. We might have actually written that down. Who knows? but yeah, that's kind of the extent of it. I rambled a bit with that one, I recognize. But, you know, whatever. I usually don't have a lot to say here. What about you?
Perfectly fine. You're covering for me a little bit. Because I did engage in things. It's just not a lot that I'm going to talk too in depth about. Nothing new. It, you know, just with work and winding down the year and things like that, I really have not been to the theater, I think, since two episodes ago, so I don't have anything brand new to talk about in the world of cinema. I mean, for Halloween...
There's not been a ton that's come out that's really worthy of going to the cinema for.
Not really. The only thing I was thinking about seeing in the movie theater and I ended up missing it was Murder in Venice. Because I heard people saying, hey, this Kenneth Branagh Hercule Poirot movie, it's actually the decent one compared to the other two. And I was like, really?
Wow.
Maybe I'll watch it. And then I did
concept. Oh, well. So I've only seen Death on the Nile, weirdly enough. And yeah, nah. still kind of mixed on really most of those actors, to be honest, especially Gal Gadot. But hey, she isn't around for long in there. Hey.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I didn't hear anyone saying it was a good movie necessarily, but people were saying it was a structured movie, which had me interested. So they were like, hey, this is like an actual film.
Truly, the bar has been lowered.
How disgusting. So let us turn back the clock to a simpler era of cheese, because I mean, we just got out of October. We did our spooky Halloween thing, and yep. I engaged with more horror games than I did horror movies, but I'm a fan of both, and I did see some horror things, but honestly, nothing new. It's all stuff I've seen before. Like Tales from the Dark Side is one that I really like. I know that has like mixed reception for some reason, but I enjoy it. I think that it's an anthology movie for those that are unaware, and it covers a wide breadth of different things. You know, there's Steve Buscemi in like a mummy story with Christian Slater, and there's another one where it's like Bill Hickey has this cat that's trying to kill him. You know, they go across a whole wide breadth of things, and I think it's an interesting movie with a lot of great puppet effects. Like a cat crawling in and out of somebody's mouth it's like, see, this is like the cheesy horror thing that I want out of these kinds of movies. And a lot of things just don't engage with that anymore. So you know what? Yeah. Big thumbs up for Tales from the Dark Side still. You know, Pumpkinhead is kind of an underrated classic sort of monster movie. And it got a recent 4K release that looks really good. I ended up picking that up, and watching Pumpkinhead. So yeah, I stand for that as well, but again, not a lot that I want to really go deep into there, just because I've seen those things before. As far as other media goes, in the world of video games, I did, you know, I picked up Super Mario Bros. Wonder for the Switch. And
hearing that Piranha song like every day of my life now, it feels like.
Yeah. Well, I ended up completing it 100%, and it's... I don't know what to say. I think it's a fantastic game, and I was actually, you know, I was standing up during some levels while I was playing. I was laughing at some of the things they were engaging with, because I think it's the first actually good 2D Mario game since Super Mario World 2, you know, Yoshi's Island on the SNES. I don't think we've had a good 2D Mario game since then.
Dear God. That's quite a gap.
Yeah, but I'm sure some people fight me, but I mean, the new Super Mario Bros. Stuff, that whole series of games, they're, like, fine, but I don't think they iterated a lot on the formula, and it just feels like cookie cutter, which is why they eventually did the Mario Maker stuff. They're like, you don't like our shit? Then make your own. And Super Mario Bros. Wonder, they're actually having fun with the formula and doing a lot of cool things that I haven't seen this franchise do before. So.
It does seem like Nintendo does come in waves with that, and every time it feels like we have reason to doubt them for a lot of their business practices and, you know, a few of their more less than okay third party instances, but whatever. whenever there's that kind of lull, you kind of expect like, oh, you know, they kind of did all their things. Like they kind of had their glut with, you know, Breath of the Wild and subsequently Tears of the Kingdom. But I kind of assume like, I feel like most people kind of assume like, okay, yeah, they're kind of, you know, on back down the back foot and maybe developing some new hardware stuff. And then they come right back steaming on in with their next great adventure. And it turns out, oh wow, you can still make Mario really fun. And it's just like, God damn it, Nintendo. Like, it's wild how much they truly know how to rededicate themselves to their IPs. And it's just like, God damn it. I mean, I wish you'd give some love to a few of your other ones at a certain point, but whatever.
Yeah.
Still would love to play an F-Zero game for once in my life.
You do F-Zero 99 or whatever.
I think there's one for the GameCube that I rented one time and I was horrible at. So maybe there's one out there somewhere. But it's, you know, I don't know. I'm not going to say that for sure because that might just be a fever dream.
Something you made up. I get it. But yeah, no, I really do dig on Mario Wonder, and it's I don't know, it's so much fun, and I was grinning the whole time I was playing it. Like, I can't even say that about Odyssey, because our Odyssey felt tedious at times with like 999 moons to collect. It's like, okay, though some are as simple as like, you found a moon that's called Walk to the Left or something stupid like that, but it doesn't matter. It just, Mario Wonder is condensed enough that I was able to 100% complete it in about 12 hours, and I think that that's perfectly justifiable, especially with how creative and fun things were. I know in the trailer at that Nintendo Direct where it was announced, they showed off, like, oh, you grab the special Wonder Flower, and, like, the environment changes and wacky things happen. I cannot underestimate how much that varies the gameplay, because every single level, every single platforming level has one of those flowers, and every single one does something different. I thought that they were going to have a bunch of repeats, but it's like, no, one of them you're, like, flying through space now, and the other one, like, speeds up everything in the world, and the other one transform your platform, and now you're on a ship with cannons that you got to jump on to shoot obstacles. It's like, every single one did something unique and interesting. It's just a fun game.
Oh, all right, maybe I'll fucking buy it, jeez.
You don't have to.
I know.
My own wonder.
It's just, you know, it sounds fun.
Yeah, but no, that's pretty much it for my experiences since last time.
Very rad. Well, I think we can keep the theme of, you know, 90s sci-fi rolling along, which I really did realize that whenever I was coming up with that stinger of, there really are quite a few mid to late 90s sci-fi comedies, action comedies specifically, like there's Fifth Element, and Men in Black in this case.
Yeah. Independence Day can be funny.
Anyway, Men in Black and Men in Black International. We'll kick things off with Men in Black from 1997. It is directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, written by Ed Solomon, and is based on the Men in Black comic series by Lowell Cunningham. Running out the main cast, we have Tommy Lee Jones as Kevin Brown / Agent K. We have Will Smith as James Darrell Edwards / Agent J, because that's not going to be confusing. Linda Fiorentino as Dr. Laurel Weaver. Vincent D'Onofrio as Edgar / The Bug. Rip Torn as Chief Zed. Tony Shalhoub as Jack Jeebs. We have Siobhan Fallon Hogan as Beatrice, Edgar's wife. And we have Mike Nussbaum as Gentle Rosenberg, the Arquillian dude that we'll see later. And also, should be good as mentioned, Tim Blaney as Frank the Pug, at least the voice of. Speaking into the plot, at the Mexico-United States border, yeah, that's where this starts, kind of forgot about that one, two men in black suits, Agent K and Agent D, interrupt a border patrol sting. They take one of the men attempting to cross the border off to the side, who is actually an extraterrestrial in disguise named Mikey. When he tries to attack one of the patrol officers who see the scene unfold, K is forced to shoot him and erase the memories of everyone in the patrol officer's group, creating a cover story of an explosion from an underground gas line. Deciding that he is too old to continue working, D chooses to retire and has K erase his memory. Meanwhile, soon after, NYPD officer James Darrell Edwards III, which it includes for some reason, catches an unnaturally agile fleeing criminal in New York City and sees that his eyes blink in an unusual way before he leaps from the roof of the Guggenheim Museum to his death. During his interrogation, Agent K arrives and scouts James as a potential new partner, impressed by his ability to chase down an alien. Kay explains to James that their organization, the Men in Black, was founded after first contact was made with extraterrestrial aliens in 1961. At this time, Earth was established as a politically neutral zone for alien refugees, being compared to Casablanca, the movie. The MIB is a secret organization that monitors and polices these aliens and uses a neuralizer device to erase the memories of anyone who witnesses alien activities. James agrees to join, taking on the new identity as Agent K, and his civilian identity is fully erased from all government records. Meanwhile, an alien crash lands up in upstate New York, killing a farmer named Edgar, and begins to wear his skin as a disguise. Jay and Kay investigate the crash site and discover that this alien is a quote-unquote bug, an extremely dangerous cockroach-like species. The bug proceeds to kill two disguised aliens, who are then sent to the city morgue, overseen by coroner Laurel Weaver. Jay and Kay inspect the bodies, and Jay and Laurel accidentally open the head of one of these disguised bodies, revealing a small, injured alien in a control cockpit. The alien tells them, quote, to prevent war, the galaxy is on Orion's belt, unquote, just before dying. Kay neuralizes Laurel and tells Jay that the alien was Rosenberg, a member of the Arquillian royal family, a species of aliens. They question an informant, one Frank the Pug, who is an alien that happens to look like a pug dog, who then explains that Rosenberg was the guardian of a galaxy that is a precious source of subatomic energy. The bug had killed Rosenberg in order to acquire it, so that the bugs may destroy the Arquillians. Frank also tells them that the galaxy is somewhere on Earth and is actually very small. An Arquillian warship then soon after enters Earth's orbit, issuing an ultimatum to the MIB to give them back the galaxy. Jay deduces that the galaxy is actually a jewel on the collar of Rosenberg's cat, who is named Orion, which is currently in Laurel's care. The bug reaches the same conclusion and arrives at the morgue just before them. It seizes and swallows the galaxy and flees with Laurel. The Arquillians, who are willing to destroy the galaxy rather than let the bugs have it, warn the MIB that they will destroy the Earth inside 1 hour unless the galaxy is returned. With all their transports locked down, Jay realizes that the bug's only escape are the observation towers in the New York State Pavilion at Flushing Meadows, which was built for the 1964 World's Fair to disguise two real flying saucers. The bug attempts to take off, but Jay and Kay shoot down the ship, whereafter the bug decides to finally shed Edgar's skin to reveal its true form while greatly expanding in size. It swallows Jay and Kay's guns, and Kay goes into swallowing him as well. The bug then begins to board the second ship. However, Jay steps on a series of cockroaches outside near a dumpster in order to antagonize it, sawing the bug long enough for Kay to find his gun inside its stomach and shoots it out from the inside. The remains of the bug, still living, begins to attack the two of them, but Laurel destroys it just in time with Jay's gun. After recovering the galaxy from the bug's remains, Kay admits to Jay that he is ready to retire from MIB and that he had actually been training Jay as his replacement rather than a partner. After bidding each other farewell, Jay neuralizes Kay, again I knew I was going to mix that up, creating a cover story that he was in a coma for the last 35 years. Laurel then soon after joins MIB as Jay's new partner as Agent L. In the closing scene, perspective pulls back across billions of light years, revealing that our Milky Way galaxy to be contained inside a similar marble to the galaxy in this movie, and is being used by aliens as basically a marble in a game of marbles. Because, it's all about existentialism and your place in reality and yada yada yada. Now, jumping over to the sort of sequel, sort of remake, just kind of a continuation in the same universe of Men in Black International, which came out in 2019. It is directed by F. Gary Gray, which is a very fun name. It's written by Art Markham and Matt Holloway. It is once again based on Men in Black by Lowell Cunningham and the original Men in Black movie. Its core cast is made up of Chris Hemsworth as Henry / Agent H, Tessa Thompson as Molly Wright / Agent M, Liam Neeson as High T, head of the MIB UK branch, Kumail Nanjiani as Pawnee, a tiny little alien guy. Rafe Spall as Agent C. Rebecca Ferguson as Risa Stavros. Laurent and Larry Bourgeois as the twins. Emma Thompson as Agent O. Haven Novak as Vungus the Ugly. Tim Blaney reprising his role as Frank the Pug, very briefly at least. And Spencer Wilding as Luca Brasi, which is a name not... Anyway, that's a name outside of this as well, if I remember correctly, but that's besides the point. Starting in 1996, Brooklyn, New York, Molly Wright witnesses her parents being neuralized by two agents from the Men in Black organization after they see an alien inside their home. Molly personally helps the alien escape, avoiding neuralization herself. 23 years later, rejected from government agencies due to her quote-unquote delusions regarding alien life, Molly tracks down an alien landing and follows MIB agents to their headquarters in New York City. She finds this landing behind the most ineffective hologram in the world, but I'll get to that. Upon entering the agency, Molly makes an impression on Agent O, the head of the New York branch, after revealing that she had bypassed neuralization, arguing that her obsessive search for them makes her the perfect for the job, and that she has no life outside her search for this agency. She is awarded probationary agent status as Agent M, and assigned to the organization's London branch, the first time we've seen any branch outside of New York. There, M meets High T, head of the London branch, and Agent H. Oh God, this sentence is going to be fun. M learns that H and T fought off an alien invasion of the Hive, a parasitic race of aliens who invade planets by merging with the DNA of a conquered species, which this invasion attempted to occur at the Eiffel Tower in 2016, using a wormhole included in the original migration to Earth that apparently had happened through the Eiffel Tower, which is at odds with the timeline that they established in the original movie, but I will get into that. H has since become unconcerned with his duties as an agent and only keeps his job due to High T covering for him. M arranges for herself to be assigned to assist H in his meeting with one alien royal member known as Vungus the Ugly, who is also H's close friend. During their night out with Vungus, they are accosted by mysterious twin aliens, referred to hereafter simply as the twins, who are able to manifest as pure energy. The twins fatally injure Vungus, who gives M a strange crystal just before he dies, claiming that H has changed since the last they met and cannot be trusted. Once they return to base, M points out that very few people knew of Vungus' location, and that he was likely betrayed by one of the agents present when High T assigned H to guard him. Nervous at the possibility of a traitor within the MIB, High T assigns Agent C and Agent M to investigate, while H is demoted back down to desk duty, with evidence suggesting that the twins had DNA traces of the Hive. H convinces M to join him, following a lead out to Marrakesh, where they recover one little alien named Pawnee, the last survivor of a small group of aliens attacked by the twins. Pawnee pledges loyalty to M, and they are trapped by MIB agents coordinated by Agent C, who recovered video footage of Vungus passing the crystal to M and believes she is the traitor. With the aid of alien contacts, Nassar and Bassam, H escapes with M and Pawnee on a rocket-powered bike, and they learn that Vungus' crystal is actually a super weapon powered by a compressed blue giant star. As they repair the damaged bike, Bassam reveals himself and steals the weapon and takes it back to H's ex-girlfriend, Riza Stavros, an alien arms dealer. Traveling to Riza's island fortress, the trio attempts to infiltrate the base, but are soon after caught by Riza and her bodyguard, Luca Brasi. Luca, who turns out to be the alien M had rescued as a child, returns the favor by allowing them to leave with the weapon while he keeps Riza contained. The three are cornered by the twins, who are then immediately killed by High T and a group of agents who had come to their rescue. Although the case appears to be concluded, H and M review the evidence and reveal that the twins' phrases suggest that they required the weapon to use against the Hive rather than in conjunction with it, especially when the only evidence of Hive DNA was provided by High T. They discover that High T has deleted the case files and not sent the weapon in question off to evidence, and has since gone to the Eiffel Tower with the weapon in tow. C also realizes High T's deception and allows H&M to follow High T to the Eiffel Tower. As they travel to the now-reopened wormhole, M's questioning of H's memory of the Hive defeat reveals that he was actually neuralized when the Hive had first attacked, and that in the subsequent neuralization, the Hive converted High T into one of their own in battle, making him a secret agent within the MIB. The High T/Hive hybrid now activates the wormhole to draw in the Hive to Earth, but H draws out High T's true personality just long enough for M, with the help of Pawnee, to use the weapon at full capacity to destroy both the hybrid and the Hive infestation trying to reach Earth. With the truth of T's conversion exposed, Agent O joins H&M in Paris, which I just realized that H&M, that's funny, where she therefore after grants M with the status of full agent and appoints H as the probationary head of the MIB London branch. They then proceed to gawk at a Lexus product placement for way longer than necessary. Oh, dear God. If that synopsis was confusing, at least for the international one, people, I am sorry. It's hard to make that concise. Truly, I added more detail to that to make it more concise.
Well, I think you did a fine job with that. God. So thank you.
No problem. My throat hurts now.
Jeez. All right. Well, I will go ahead and take us into full circle for some break. Have a number here. I'll try to, and once again, I pared it down as much as I felt was possible, but I'll try to move through it as relatively quickly as possible. So firstly, Becky Ann Baker, as Mrs. Redgick in 1997's Men in Black. She played the head nurse in 1990's Jacob's Ladder, movie I'm very fond of.
Nice.
Sergio Calderon was Jose in Men in Black, and was Alfonso in 1979's The In-Laws.
Couldn't honestly remember that character. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Tim Blaney is the voice of Frank the Pug in Men in Black. apparently was a Muppet performer in the most recent string of Muppets properties, including 2011's The Muppets, which we covered, and also operated as a puppeteer on Ron Howard's 2000 classic, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. So Tim Blaney's a puppeteer, apparently. I was not aware.
I'm damned.
Tommy Lee Jones is Agent K in Men in Black. We just covered him fairly recently as Chester Phillips in Captain America: The First Avenger, our MCU episode.
Oh, yeah. Shit. I kind of forget that there was that we did that as an entry, because, God, that original is so forgettable.
Yeah. That was this year, too. We've been doing this for 5+ years now. And next is Vern Troyer, who played the alien son in Men in Black, was also one of the band members in How the Grinch Stole Christmas from 2000, and was the mini Santa in the warehouse in 1996's Jingle All the Way. Another classic.
Huh. Kind of forgot about that.
And finally, for the 97 Men in Black, we have, of course, Will Smith as Agent J, who we also saw as Captain Stephen Hiller in Independence Day, which we briefly mentioned earlier, and the genie in 2019's Aladdin.
No, no need to say more about that, man. He's been through the ringer enough lately.
Yeah. We will step into Men in Black International with Chris Hemsworth as Agent H. We touched on him recently as well, as Jed Eckert in the 2012 Red Dawn remake. He was also Kevin in 2016's Ghostbusters Answer the Call. I guess that'd be our third or fourth episode? Third episode. I think fourth was True Grit.
Oh, God, yeah, that's true. That was a while ago.
Yes. We were still in college when we recorded that one. Emma Thompson was Agent O in Men in Black International. She was also Mrs. Potts in 2017's Beauty and the Beast, another Disney link.
She does quite a bit of that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I lost my place. Oh, okay. Liam Neeson was Agent High T in Men in Black International, and was Zeus in the recent Clash of the Titans.
Still hate that name, High T.
Yeah, it's bad, but I guess they got it. There's only 26 letters in the alphabet. I guess they got to distinguish somehow. Michael Adams played a character called Michael Adams in Men in Black International, apparently. He was also Travis in 83's War Games, another one from this year. And finally, going back to another entry we've already discussed, Stephen Khalifa was the antique shopkeeper in Men in Black International and also played a mom in 2019's Aladdin.
Oh, okay. I was right about that one.
And that's it for Full Circle.
Fantastic. Got any initial thoughts while I take a drink of water and save my vocal cords?
Yeah. So, as far as your opinion on these movies, which we'll get into, we're talking about my opinion right now. I'm interested what your thoughts are, because I don't necessarily know where this one's going to go, but I'm not going to beat around the bush, and I'm just going to come out and say that Men in Black International was so fucking boring that I barely remember a single thing about it.
Yeah,
I had to pay extra attention to your synopsis to even remember what happens in this fucking movie, because I forgot about it the morning after.
Yeah, there was a definite feeling of that with me as well. Not quite as visceral as I believe yours is. But yeah, there was something about this one where it just... I enjoyed it. I will say that. I enjoyed it while I was watching it. I didn't think it was bad for any particular reason, but I'll get into the specifics of, you know, why it's not necessarily great either. But yeah, there's just something about it that isn't super distinctive, which I think comes down to the fact that all of the main characters don't really have the greatest screen presence. Like, you compare that to the original, where even, you know, the fucking, like, head of the, you know, New York branch, whose name, Rip Torn, sorry, even he has such a distinctive presence, just based on his voice and just his bearing and everything. Even comparing that to Emma Thompson Emma Thompson has a very reserved way about her. Like, I know she is she can, you know, have characters who are a bit more odd and more outlandish and that sort of thing, but she's a much more grounded seeming person, and maybe just for the fact that she's British. So even comparing that, it didn't really leave much of her remembrance. And I know she was originally introduced in, you know, Men in Black 3, which we won't even get into that. I don't know. There's just a whole lot of going on in Men in Black International. And I think a lot of it has to do with, the fact that no one in particular really has a standout moment that you get with, you know, even Tommy Lee Jones being the driest human being on Earth that he is, that works as his character. And I kind of thought we were going to have a cool switch up with that, because they mix up the dichotomy of the two main characters in this compared to the original. Because in the original, it's the new person is the hotshot and kind of go-getter sort of thing, versus the old guard dude is more reserved and more restringent with protocol sort of stuff. And then Men in Black International, it's fully flipped. It's the agent who's been there for longer is the kind of hotshot, not giving a shit mentality, versus the new girl is like a Boy Scout, essentially, or Girl Scout, I guess. I don't know how they strict there. Anyway, point being, it flips out on its head, and I kind of thought that would do something, but it ends up making Chris Hemsworth's character kind of just like consistently fucking up, and it makes Emma Thompson's character a bit Mary Sue. And that's not great. I say that as if, you know, any of these characters aren't at least a little Mary Sue at all times, but, you know, I think you get what I mean.
Yeah, it's... So, the thing... So, between J and K, Tommy Lee and Will Smith in the original movie, I'm not saying that that pairing is necessarily groundbreaking by any means. I mean, at this point in human history, what ideas aren't already aping off of pre-existing, you know, puzzle pieces? You're just fitting them together in new configurations, hopefully. But what we have there is more so of the mentor-mentee sort of relationship, where Tommy Lee Jones is like a pseudo-father figure to Will Smith, as he's the one that sees the potential in him and brings him into this fold, blah, blah, blah. And again, I think they go too hard on that in Men in Black 3, but we're not here to talk about Men in Black 3. As far as the first movie stands, I think that relationship is more interesting because Will Smith is this sort of hotshot, you know, whatever, come at me, bro, sort of character. But it's not necessarily like he's at odds with Tommy Lee Jones. Tommy Lee Jones is a different type of character in the movie, but he's the one that sees greatness in Will Smith and acts as this sort of guide through the agency, which is why I think that they play off really well together. And they immediately start performing, like, Will Smith fucks up by shooting at D'Onofrio and, like, blowing up a car, and so he gets reprimanded a little bit. But they're not constantly at odds. They immediately just get into it, and, you know, they're partners, and it feels like that they know each other really well. The only real difference is that Will Smith doesn't have all of the experience, so he can occasionally be the audience stand-in and act surprised at various things that are going on with this sort of new facet of reality he's discovering. I just find the relationship between Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth characters in the new movie pretty bland and hackneyed, because it's like the lone wolf character who gets paired up with the bright-eyed newbie, and they're at odds, and they have to come to understand each other, and they don't do anything interesting with that. So they're constantly at odds until a bit later in the movie, when they're finally like, okay, we need to get together and fix a fucking bike in the desert for 45 minutes so that we can get on with our lives. I don't think that this movie does anything. Again, Men in Black 97 isn't groundbreaking by any means, but I don't think International does enough to try and change up any of the formulas. It just feels like a bunch of pre-existing ideas put into a blender with the Men in Black franchise name slapped onto the front of it. There's not much for me to glom onto here.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the charm of the original comes from the fact that there's a distinct feeling of novelty throughout the entire thing. Like, that's a genuine theme going through this. Like, just the sense of discovering these alien creatures and the extent that they exist within our own society. The whole thing is meant to be this moment of, wow, this is surprising in all these really like wild and crazy ways. And, you know, you have that moment where he's handed the extremely tiny handgun that actually is able to, you know, blow holes through tractor trailers and everything. And, you know, we have these moments where it's like, oh, we go up to this one guy who looks like this emaciated husk. It's like, oh, this guy must be an alien. Turns out, no, it's actually his dog sitting next to him. It's this consistent feeling throughout, you know, with the, like you said, the medium of, you know, having Jay act as kind of the audience stand-in of recognizing, oh, this is crazy and whimsical and how the world is interacting with itself. Like, even just the introduction of the MIB headquarters was crazy. Just seeing all these various people show up and, like, how they act so casually around all these seemingly absurd happenings and everything. I think my favorite movie, like, I think my favorite moment in all this was just when they're going through the initial training regimen for, you know, Jay, of, you know, when he's, you know, getting vetted alongside those other, you know, like, army types. He walks into that break room and we just see the, like, series of little I can't remember, they have a specific name, but, like, the, you know, now iconic, like, kind of like bug looking shorter alien guys who are always like chattering with themselves. There's a very fun moment where they're pouring coffee for each other, and it's clearly like, you know, they're messing everything up, they're not doing it in any kind of coordinated fashion, and they pour this, you know, pot of coffee off the side of this counter, and it's spilling a whole bunch as they, you know, fill up their cup. But you see it interacting with the cabinet behind them. Like, it's spilling onto the cabinet. You see them interacting with objects on the counters. And it's these CG characters who are being shown to interacting with the real world, like with a real physical props. And it's details like that that make it work. It's the little things of you have to make sure, like, oh, yeah, this is a CG character, but they have to interact with the world so we believe that they're real. And it's that novelty that's just completely gone at MIB International. My God, it is so CG'd to hell, and everything feels so casual now of, like, we understand, like, aliens are real and all that sort of thing, big whoop. And it just really just turns into a very bland spy flick. Like, the sense of novelty is fully gone. Like, this girl is a true believer from the word go, and so we don't have any of those moments of how could we actually push the boundary with this? The answer is we don't. We just make it a spy movie, because that's all it is. It's running around and going after arms dealers and, you know, like, fending off invasions and that sort of thing. Which, again, I need to bring it up in wholesale now. What is the timeline in this freaking movie? Because they established in the first one, the earliest first encounter was in 61, specifically at Roswell. But then all of a sudden, they bring up in this one that apparently Monsieur Eiffel, who designed the Eiffel Tower, actually designed it to be a portal for alien migration. So that was the first encounter? And it was just this one dude? Or was that an organization thing? The organization didn't exist at that point. It was an American invention. Like, what the fuck is going on?
I don't know. I think International has a lot of problems that it really has to work through. And I'll let you get to your piece soon, because, like you said, I know that you said you had some positives for this, and maybe I will after hearing you talk. But I just have so many reasons that I don't really care for it. And I think that talking about the CG thing, I mean, for Men in Black 97... It's a mix. There's CG that, you know, is integrated well into the picture itself, and then there's also practical effects where they can make use of it, specifically with the more humanoid aliens. And, you know, I think that's fine. But I don't think there's anything really interesting with the creatures that show up in International, because they're all the CG humanoids. There's the disgusting whatever guy, Vungus Vargas, that clown that ends up dying at the beginning, and he's just some generic humanoid creature. And then there's the guy that is working for Rebecca Ferguson's character later, who is just some giant humanoid whatever that speaks some language.
And he's like, he has feathers, he's named after a fucking mafia enforcer for some reason.
Yeah, I don't... The closest they get to something that's interesting, I guess, as far as characters go, are the little guys that sort of operate on chess rules, and they have the different chess names. But that wears out its welcome very quick, because then we get Pawnee, voiced by Kumail Nanjiani, tagging along for the journey. And literally, I know we've harped about this on the past, the dialogue that they give this character is worse than anything that I have talked about in a Marvel movie recently, because every other line out of his fucking mouth is just like a snarky response, whatever. Like, oh my God, there was one where I was literally flummoxed. Like, I think it was literally like, wow, did that just happen? He like actually says that, you know, that's like a meme at this point, but he actually goes, did that just happen? Yeah, that happened. But the other characters aren't, you know, they aren't free from that criticism either, because Tessa Thompson's character, Molly, fires a gun early in the movie and it has a lot of kickback or something. And she literally says, check, please. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? I can't remember the last time I heard that unironically someone say that.
To be fair, that's better than a lot of Marvel shit. Like, that's a more classic line that I'm willing to forgive a lot more than that just happened. There's a geekiness to her delivery of it that I'm like, all right, yeah, if I were in her shoes, after hunting down this alien tracking organization, I'd probably be like, okay, this is fun.
Might be where we diverge a little bit, because I was like, oh my God, what am I watching?
Well, I think that is kind of part of my own redeeming qualities for the movie, is I think Tessa Thompson specifically has what little heart there is to this movie. She holds it, because it's clear there's just kind of a fun fascination with her throughout this that I think kind of carries the emotional side of it. Even just the moments where, you know, they're having the shootout with the twins, which, by the way, talking about like character designs, those are pretty good. They're like, whenever they manifest in their true form, they're like, basically like controlled like nebulas that are able to basically warp, you know, the physical states of matter around them. I also thought that was kind of cool. You know, nothing like too horribly groundbreaking, obviously, but, you know, I they were definitely the most interesting character here. Fucking the Hive is basically
enough. Enough designs. It's just a lot of times they were in like skin suits or something.
Yeah, they were disguised as they disguised as actual humans. So not as cool. Meanwhile, we have like the Hive, which is basically just the symbiote from, you know, from Spider-Man, but not somehow less interesting. But yeah, I think to talk about the positive side of things, I definitely like Tessa Thompson's character, just kind of in general. I think ultimately there's a certain joyous geekiness that I think this movie was kind of lacking that it needed, even this movie series really. there's a bit of cynicism at times that can get a little overbearing with the 1997 one, which I know is ultimately kind of part of the point, but there really is no point where anyone feels truly like whimsically fascinated with the situation other than like Agent L at the very end. But even then, it's kind of more stoic badass fascination than anything, which we never see her character again. She gets retconned out of the existence in the second movie.
I thought she was in the second movie, wasn't she?
She's very briefly brought up having like she got like she got kicked out or something, whatever it was. I'm not sure what it was.
Okay. It's been a while since I've watched those, but I thought I remembered.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she wasn't in the second one. It was kind of lame. But point I'm getting to here is, I like Tessa Thompson's presence, and I think she brought a bit of levity that it needed. I'll also say there's a certain aspect of the style that they're going for in International that I actually kind of prefer to the original. There's a certain sense of, a good way to put it, the movie feel, the original 1997 one, it feels like it takes place in New York. It is one of the most New York feeling movies I've seen, because dear God, does it make it look dirty and disgusting at every scene. It's just, it feels like at all times there's like this feeling of grime, even when you're in the super sleek MIB headquarters. It feels like there's this kind of like light film over everything, which is, I guess, kind of the point. But it's just, there's a very feeling of grossness between like characters getting like exploded and like the cockroaches at the end that he stomps at apparently are basically fruit gushers. Obviously the bug himself is just this disgusting creature that lives in this decaying skin suit, which, can we just like shout out to some, like, to give some love to just Edgar as a character as a whole in the original one, because I don't want to shit on this too much right now without talking about the fact of Edgar is one of the coolest like movie villains put to screen in that era, simply for the fact of, one, Vincent D'Onofrio was incredible, just like showing like it looks like, it truly looks like a creature that's living inside a skin suit. The design of him looking so otherworldly and so uncanny valley at all times is really good. The fact that his skin literally decays over the course of the film until he's basically just already falling off by the end, I just adore his design. I adore that character. It's one of my favorites of all time.
No, I agree. I think D'Onofrio specifically does a fantastic job actually acting in this. And, I mean, Rick Baker, I know we've mentioned him on the show before. He's probably one of the greatest living visual effects artists out there, next to, like, Tom Savini. And he's responsible for a lot of the actual practical effects that are in this movie, especially with all the D'Onofrio stuff. So, I mean, that can't be ignored.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's fine. But I didn't want to say anything else because I knew that you were on a.
No, it's fine. Sorry, I got distracted by my phone for a second. But yeah, but you know, back to the point I was making of like kind of the differences in style. Like the original has this like very distinctly kind of gross, kind of grimy thing going on with it, and the MIB International has this a cool sleekness to it that I wasn't expecting. Like the technology they have on display compared to the original, it's not as like junky feeling or clunky feeling. There's a bit more of a consistency throughout of, you know, we have these, you know, like this agent car that has all these absurd, insane hidden compartments of holding like wider ranges of weaponry and everything that are able to hide in plain sight and everything. A lot of the techno, there's a consistent use of the color blue that I actually kind of like, just like a basically being alien technology. It looks blue. And I don't know, just something about it. Just, I liked what they went for with the design ethos on this by comparison. It seemed like they decided, you know what, if we're going to be more fully CG, we're going to make use of it and be a bit more sleek and kind of futuristic feeling. Whereas the original mixed its CG with its practical stuff and as a result, I think, created that, you know, more design of it being more kind of, you know, grimy feeling and everything, which I think each design works for it. I just kind of personally prefer the sleek style of the new one. And again, I think that might just be me enjoying it as a spy flick more than anything like the sci-fi of the original.
What I will say is that because I'm constantly bitching about new sci-fi movies because they are all shot in blue, I'll say that I think that the color scheme for International does work very well, and I think it works wonders with the set design where there's actual set design to admire. Because for folks that may have picked up on that, it's like, yeah, I don't like recent sci-fi movies because they're like shot with a blue film over the camera, which is not the same as the blue that we're talking here. It's like a soft technological blue that's paired with the white sleekness of the backgrounds and the various devices. Like there's a bullet train that gets used for transporting aliens and I guess people in the know, especially within the agency, and transports them underground. And like that's a sleek looking design. It's like a white train with this futuristic blue sort of visor for the front window. And I think that stuff like that looks really cool and it does service it. I think ultimately I prefer, and this, speaking of like you preferring like the spy aspect or whatever, I think this just goes back to like the sort of grimy, gross, practical sort of horror thing that I tend to be into, but through a sci-fi
lens. That's true, yeah.
Is why I think I get more out of the 97 in that respect, because there's more for me to latch onto there. But while we're talking like the, or while I'm talking about the bullet train that transports the folks, something that confused me going into this movie is that for some reason I thought that Men in Black International meant that it was like a globe-trotting Men in Black adventure, but the International really just means that it doesn't take place in America because they go to like three places.
Yeah, in total they go to...
I thought there was going
to
be a lot more traveling around than there actually was.
Yeah, as it is, it's very much... You know what it is? It's very much the kind of classical European idea of international, that being from our home state of England, we have journeyed to France, and now we are in North Africa. It's like Morocco being like the most foreign place that this movie goes to, and very much being the most foreign place the early 1800s gentleman might end up in. I had that feeling as well. I was kind of disappointed with that. It didn't really see, like, again, it really just fully feels like they really just kind of came up with the name before anything else, because they didn't really do anything with it and just kind of made it a very generic spy flick. Because it pretty much did all that stuff for going to like arms dealers and like contacts in, you know, African, you know, like North African / Middle Eastern, you know, marketplaces and all these sorts of things, like chases through market stalls and everything. It's like, like if Indiana Jones and James Bond had a, you know, torrid love affair, and then also it was in sci-fi.
Yeah.
It's not international. It's European, and Morocco is a sphere of European influence at this point.
Men in Black European Vacation.
Really, yeah. They treat Morocco like it's basically still part of like the Europe zone of influence, like it was back in the day. It's just kind of like, oh, you know, we have stuff going on there. It's like it's still a whole other continent, but all right, guys.
The moment they went there, I was honestly rolling my eyes because I was like, okay, so they're gonna have like a moped chase through a bazaar. Is that coming up? And they do get on a bike, and I was like, oh fuck, where are we going from here? I've seen this a million times. Thankfully, it's they did nothing. Not ride around the streets of Morocco, but they could have.
They nearly did. So it's just, it feels like it's hard talking at length about this one because it just, there's so many moments where it just feels like they just weren't really doing much of anything with the concept that they had. Like, again, even just with the thing of bringing up the fact of, you know, Eiffel Tower being this wormhole thing, you know, not, you know, bullshit timelining, not aside, like, bit aside, it just kind of comes up right at the very beginning, very briefly, and then right at the end. And so it's like, the fact that it came up at the beginning and we had this just weird cutaway, I immediately knew full well, okay, the high T character is a traitor. Like, that's it. Like, this is the most predictable shit in the world. And just, it didn't come up again. Like, I feel like if it had integrated a bit more with the wider plot, it would have been a bit nicer. But, although I guess, to be fair, they sort of do that in the original as well, when they bring up, like, the saucers in, you know, Prospect Park at the very beginning, because talking about, like, oh, these are the Roswell things that we moved to New York. And then it turns out, oh, later he's actually going to use those very things as a means of escape. But that is at least a more subtle Chekhov's gun versus the original, the remake basically being like, this is where the plot's going to go in the first, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, International does a lot of hand-holding throughout. One of the primary examples comes pretty early in the movie when Molly, Tessa Thompson's character, it's not when she first gets into the Men in Black facility, but it's after O has been like, okay, you can be temporary whatever, trial period. And she's next to a bunch of aliens, and Chris Hemsworth walks in, and he's moving in slow motion, and there's this alien next to her that's playing with its hair. And the camera keeps zooming in on her playing with her hair. And I was like, okay, so her, like, the joke is like her hair is controlling the speed that Hemsworth's moving. But then he starts going in reverse and then going forward, going reverse, going forward. And then it zooms in on her playing with her hair again, but no one's saying anything. And I was like, does the movie think I'm an idiot? Like, is this supposed to be a really funny reveal? And then they finally reveal, oh, her hair was controlling. It's like, yeah, I picked up on that like 2 minutes ago. And I know that's me ranting about, like, a 15-second scene, but I feel like the movie is full of a lot of things like that where it's really hand-holdy and doesn't trust the audience to understand what's going on. And the Eiffel Tower is the most egregious example of that.
Oh, God, yeah. Like, of course, they had to do it internationally. I mean, it feels like integrating the fucking Eiffel Tower into movies is the modern equivalent of integrating the Empire State Building in some capacity into some movie. Of being like, oh, it's something more than that the whole time, or, like, it's going to be a big, you know, scene of a climactic fight. Between this and fucking Tomorrowland, it's like the Eiffel Tower has gotten more prevalent prominence than I would have expected. Which, remember Tomorrowland? Oh my god.
I do. Barely. But.
And also, like, to that end of like hand holdingness, they also do that with Agent, like it also does that with Tessa Thompson's and Chris Hemsworth's characters' relationship to each other, where in the original there's a very distinct feeling of, yeah, it's very much like a student mentor kind of thing, and the development happens pretty naturally. In this one, it's very much just like, yeah, I am doing outlandish and suicidal things because I don't care, and all these things. And then it reveals later, it's like, oh, I am actually sensitive, and here is my real name, it's Henry, and all these different things. And you, Tessa Thompson, will get basically none of this character development, as I basically just use you as my therapist. Would, like, you know, describe every relationship I've ever known of other friends, and yeah, I'm just like, okay, let's not get into that one.
Well, she's perfect. She doesn't have anywhere to go. Right, you know, exactly. She knows what she's about. She already knows aliens exist. She's able to sneak into the agency.
Let's talk about the two laziest goddamn MIB agents there at the very beginning, who they are told outright, like, they have a situation where there is an alien at these people's home. They need to go in and make sure it's not gotten out very much. And also, I was kind of hoping at some point, like, that was going to be a cameo from, you know, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. Like, they're the two that show up there, which I almost guarantee they wanted to do at some point, but then they realized they had to make him incompetent as possible, because they show up, they don't go inside the house, they are told fully that there is a child in the home. They don't bother to check to see if she's really asleep. They just fucking neuralize the two parents out front. They don't go inside to find the alien, and then they just piss off, leaving this girl with this knowledge of this alien, and that's just allowed to stand. It's like, y'all didn't do anything here. Like, why did you show up?
Well, that's something, honestly, that's something that bothered me throughout Men in Black International as well, is that in the original movie, they introduced the concept of the neuralizers to white people's memories, and they're acting like a secret agency would, where they only use the neuralizers where necessary. They still try to use discretion and not actually, you know, reveal what's going on. But in Men in Black International, every single person acts the same way, where the minute a civilian comes up to them, they're like, yeah, this is exactly what's happening. There's aliens. Aliens are real. Ha ha. And then they wipe their memory. It's like, why even bother at that point? Like, yeah. It's so weird how lackadaisical every single character is in the remake about this secret, because they're all like, well, I'm just going to wipe their memory anyways. Might as well tell them. Which,
to be fair,
it doesn't do well for the world building.
To be fair on that aspect, Tommy Lee Jones' character does a bit of that as well, but he's still so casual about it that it almost doesn't really register with you, which I think is the point. I think he's meant to have this friendly demeanor where he's like, oh, you know, here's the situation. That was a particular kind of alien, and look here real quick, and we're done. Bye. he has very much the sense of control over the situation that the MIB International folks definitely don't. They just fuck around with it more than anything, like you said.
Yeah, and maybe I'm just a hypocrite in, like, giving Tommy Lee Jones too much credit, but I think because he is just such... Tommy Lee Jones, no matter what he's doing, just seems like such a miserable bastard on screen and in real life.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like even when he's doing it, he's just trying to get through his day, where everyone in Men in Black International seems very unprofessional.
Oh, yeah. Okay, and one more thing I gotta bring up, because there's a scene that happened in the original trailer of this that I've been wanting to harp on for years now. There's the moment where Tessa Thompson's character finally, like, tracks down the MIB agents and sees them taking away an alien and is able to follow them to their headquarters. The way this happens is she goes up to, she sees them go down an alleyway, and when she looks down it, there's nothing there. What is instead there is a permeable illusion that she can walk through. Behind, it is an illusion of a solid fence that she is able to just pass through, which is less effective than a normal fence.
Yes.
If they had just put up a fence, this wouldn't have happened. But she was able to just pass through it with no issue, and then she's able to see this entire scene unfold. I have been so irrationally annoyed by that concept ever since I saw it in the first trailer that showed that. And I was like, why, on the grace of God, would you not just put up a temporary fence in front of your illusion just to make sure people don't stay a little bit further away so they don't just wander through by accident? Because she even sees birds fly through it. So any normal person could have seen, like, oh, there's birds going through what should just be a solid fence. I'm going to go through that solid fence. At least if they saw birds going through it and there was a solid fence in front of them, it would at least deter them a little. It's like, my God, it's so ass backwards, confusingly bad.
Also, humans like to touch things.
Yeah.
Like, I still will just, you know, when I'm walking by a fence, just put my finger, it doesn't matter how dirty the fucking fence is, I don't know who's touched it or licked it or whatever, I'll put my hand on it and just, like, down the slats as I'm moving. Like, what's to stop someone from doing that and being like, oh, my hand phased through it, am I dying? Like, I've never, like, we don't have this technology.
Yeah. Like,
what an awful idea.
I know. It's just, that's kind of the whole, excuse me. And that's kind of the whole thing, like you said. In the original, they genuinely felt like the, you know, mythicized, like, conspiracy theory of the men in black. Like, literally the true conspiracy theory that there are just these shadowy men in black suits, which were a thing in reality, like, back during, like, the right. Cold War especially. But that they, more than just, like, government agents, like, tracking, like, for communists and that sort of thing, they were, you know, doing things involving with aliens. They actually truly play into that in the original and are considered, you know, like you said, they act as if they are still at all times trying to be as under the radar as possible, even in moments where they know they ultimately will have, you know, basically full control over the situation. And in MIB International, God knows they do not give half a hell. It's just so, it seems, what's really funny that I just realized, with the exception of the fence thing, obviously, but there's a brief moment where she's getting on that train that's going to take her across the entire world, like in a few minutes. It's very briefly arrives in the station, just looking like a normal New York subway train, which tells me that in New York, there's such a shortage of trains, or there's such a widespread tracking of these trains that at times it has to still be working as an in-service New York subway train before otherwise coming to this, you know, like MIB train station before it transforms. It's just this nice little detail of, oh yeah, no, they're still doing secretive shit. It's just once you go to international, they don't give half a hell. It's like,
which I find that funny, but then, not to be nitpicky, but then I'm like, okay, so do people regularly accidentally get on the train and then it transforms and there's like an old woman, like, what's happening? Or is there like a subset of the agency that specifically only sells tickets to common civilians when it's operating as a normal train?
Yeah,
like,
no, there's
logistics that I'm curious about.
Yeah, there's a logistical side that is definitely kind of overlooked, but, you know, it's just kind of a funny little thought of like, oh, they have to, you know, right, stay integrated with New York's, you know, transit authority so directly that, yeah, this train's still going to operate as like a normal subway car. It's, meanwhile, if you go international, they're like, who gives a shit? It's like, we're in England, yeah, we're in France, no one's going to pay attention.
Everyone in England might as well just be a member of this agency. They care so little.
Basically, like, it's, I'm not unconvinced that the entirety of England is not just made up of aliens. Which I actually have, relating to that whole thing, like, there's a running joke throughout all these movies of, oh, this real life person is actually an alien in disguise, which I gotta say, they did Donald Glover kind of dirty in this one. There's a joke where they go like, oh, it's really surprising, you wouldn't have expected that person to be an alien, and then Tessa Thompson goes, no, that one's not surprising, and it shows Donald Glover. I'm like, what did Donald Glover do? he's a very respectable actor, a very successful musician or artist and that sort of thing. Like, what's so like immediately obvious that, like, it would have been more funny if they just didn't bring it up. It's like, oh, that one's actually surprising. It's like, no, I'm not surprised that he's an alien. It's like, why? Like,
well, and the weird thing about that is that the image right before Donald Glover is Elon Musk, which would have been much more fitting. I mean, this is 2019, and a lot more people were on Musk's side at that time, but he's still like a billionaire. I think that would have been more fitting.
Yeah, like, come on. There was a moment of that where I was like, all right, that's unnecessary. It's like, there are other moments in some of the other movies where they bring up that, you know, Michael Jackson makes a cameo in the second movie where it's like, oh, that's fun. Which, you know, dating itself, my God.
Yeah.
But... and just, but the, I do have my question that I'll ask at the end of this is relating to that, and I just had that thought whenever I was thinking about the fact of in this world, it's like, hey, maybe everyone in England just is an alien, like all those, like that one throwaway thing of, oh, we were part of the first migration of aliens here, and it's that one weird dopey looking alien, and I was like, yeah, I could see a whole slew of English citizens that are descended from them, like that seems real. Which, again, they completely gloss over that whole thing of like, oh, we're part of the first alien migration and all this sort of stuff, despite the fact that it predates what should have been the earliest human encounter and the establishment of this organization as a whole by a good... I mean, shit, the Eiffel Tower went up in like the late 1800s, my God. It predates it by at least a good 60 years. It's like, what is the point of this line other than we want to have a wormhole in the Eiffel Tower? It's like, they could have added that later.
I'm not going to claim that 97's is, like, airtight in terms of lore, but...
No.
Again, this just goes back to, like, Men in Black and, like, The Fifth Element and, like, things like that, that they just care more about constructing the world that they live in. And yeah. Men in Black International, to its credit, does throw some interesting ideas at the wall, but I don't think that the people writing this or working on it actively cared about trying to put the pieces together, because at the end of the day, it's just a particular story they wanted to tell and then fitting it into a pre-existing IP to try to make money off of it. And I know that's more of a studio thing than a writer thing. I'm just saying that it doesn't feel like there was someone that was, like, caring about how all these pieces fit together at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I think the biggest kind of sign of that is the fact that the Prospect Park saucers are actually alien ships that's a real world like theory. That was the thing, like when they first built that for the World's Fair, it's like, oh, are those actually like spaceships that they're trying to do? And that was kind of part of the theme they're doing for that World's Fair. It's obviously there's meant to be a sort of sense of futurism. That was a very big thing at the time. And so integrating that into this movie was like, oh, what if we actually did something with this longstanding theory? I got to tell you, I don't think there's any true water held in any theories that the Eiffel Tower was anything other than a French passion project. Like, I don't, like, there's never been a whole thing of, oh, it was actually like an antenna for an alien wormhole. It's like, that one they made up. Like, there's no real integration there. Yeah, that's just like, oh, we wanted to integrate another real world landmark into this, you know, into this whole theory, which it doesn't talk about the fact that basically all of Paris saw a giant wormhole going into this. At the very least with New York and the saucers, like, yeah, maybe just this one particular area of fucking, I don't know, Queens or Brooklyn. I'm not sure where that park is. But maybe this one particular area saw some shit going down with that building. But that could be explained away in something. All of Paris was going to see that giant spotlight coming from their most iconic landmark. Come on.
And again, not to... I think we're winding down here because we're making our thoughts well known. But
yeah, we're pretty much there.
I feel like I keep being like this, you know, nitpicker, like hipster, whatever. It's just... I don't know, the saucers from the World's Fair are at least interesting, because I don't think that's comparable to the Eiffel Tower, which just feels kind of lazy. It'd be like if in Men in Black 97, they were like, well, the Statue of Liberty is actually a mothership, and when it launches, the flame she's holding flips upside down and is a real flame. Like, they're not doing that, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Eiffel Tower feels lazy.
It doesn't really do anything with it. It's just like, oh, there's a portal. It's like, really, we're doing Sky Portal again in the year 2023? Or sorry, 2019 in this case. Like, I feel like that is no longer tried and true. That is tried, true, and sent out to pasture. It's, I don't know. Yeah, like you said, it feels lazy. And it's also, at the very end, it is all bookmarked by the most egregious Lexus fucking advertisement I've ever seen.
Forgotten about that.
Yeah, like, there's a whole, like, reveal of this car of, like, oh, you expect it to be, like, this insane, like, supercar and everything. But it looks like a pretty normal, if nice, Lexus. And I'm like, God fucking damn it. Like, at least in the original, like, the car they had was pretty unassuming, and so when it did do something cool, it was like, whoa, that's wacky. But in this one, at the very least, like, they could have, like, pushed the envelope and been like, what if it's just a straight-up Lamborghini or a Bugatti or just, like, something so next-level nice where it's like, yeah, this is badass. But no, because it was a Lexus, I was like, this is an advertisement. This is just an advertisement and nothing else. And they kept talking about it being in the car, and the ending scene is being like, oh, I didn't go back to New York yet because I wanted to drive this bad boy back, and, like, talking about all the things about it. I'm like, shut up. You have destroyed all goodwill you have given me of this movie. Like, let's just wrap this up. Rather than having an emotional character moment or establish that you guys... And that's the thing. It established fully, like, oh, these guys are going to be separated and they're going to be doing their own full-time gigs now. It just almost fully established that, no, we're not going to do more movies with these people. They're doing their own thing and they're just driving off into the literal sunset, or sunrise in this case. And it's just like... So instead of having any sort of, like, feeling of closure, or maybe this story will continue in some other aspect, we're just going to drive our advertisement right off into the credits. It's like... All right.
I mean, if that little creature voiced by Kumail Nanjiani is going to be tagging along with him, I don't want to see any of their other adventures.
I guess so.
I will let them fade,
no
fade
shame,
away.
No shame to Mr. Nanjiani. I think he's an extremely funny comedian. I think he's done a lot of very good roles. Dear God, this role was insufferable.
I think he's been funny, too. It's just he's been going down a very dark path. Yes. Kind of peaked with him getting roided out for that Eternals movie. It's like, yeah, we got to make him into a giant muscle-bound monster for this Marvel flick.
Yeah, it's like, why do they feel the need to give him the fucking Chris Pratt treatment? Like, it wasn't great when they did it to Chris Pratt, let's be real.
I do not know.
Yeah, I think we've made our opinions pretty well known. I gotta say, I didn't actively dislike MIB International, but it just didn't really feel like anything worth remembering. Like, I'm surprised I remembered as much of it as I did.
Well, and that's the thing, too. I've complained about International a lot here because I have a lot of grievances with it, but I don't actively hate it. It's just so... boring to me, which is almost worse.
Yeah. Even then, like, even thinking about the original, it's never been my favorite, but at least it had, like, a charm to it going on, you know? It was very distinctly itself.
I think it has enough actors that I enjoy doing things that, like, I've always loved Rip Torn. I think he's great, even if he, you know, had demons in his real life. I think he's always been a great actor. I like Tommy Lee Jones, even though he's a prickly bastard. Even people in minor roles, like, we didn't really touch on Tony Shalhoub, who's in this movie. It's like, I like Tony Shalhoub, you know? Monk isn't a great show, but I like Tony Shalhoub in it. So, I think he was in Galaxy Quest, and I like him in that. Like, you know, there's enough goodwill that I have towards the movie because there are people in it that I enjoy doing fun things and interacting with each other. that coupled with like the gross 90s practical effects sort of thing mixed in with it makes it something that I can, it's easily accessible to me, I guess.
Oh, I gotcha. I think it's kind of a similar boat for me. But yeah, it's just, it's hard to compare the two where it's still like at a certain point, it's like, yeah, we're just kind of harping on shit at this point, which as if either of these movies are very tight with their lore.
Yeah. Which, I mean, sometimes we get those, it happens, but,
but I will pose this to you because like I said, I do have a question for you to ponder.
Okay.
Like,
I was going to say, I think we both have one. I just wanted to know who was going to go first.
I'll go first this time, just simply for the fact that I actually had one planned out this time. And this is a question that can be done with somewhat of a grain of salt because there, like I said, there's a running background joke of in these movies of there are real life celebrities or individuals who actually are turned out to be aliens. Now, this can be misconstrued in ways basically saying, you know, this particular person acts weird, therefore they're an alien, which could be an instance of just like neurodivergency or just a different personality, or they're just a very eccentric person. To try to avoid that sort of side of it, what would you say, what real life figure would you say could be an alien in this universe?
Wow. I mean, it's hard to go into that without being like, you know, does this person have problems? But I guess, you know, for more like celebrities and more public figures, it's, especially for people that can be agreed on, it's less controversial. I guess Tom Green would be an easy one. I could see him being an alien.
Fair.
Andy Dick.
yeah, that'd be fun. Woody Allen.
Woody Allen is a little freak, yeah.
Nice.
Oh man, this is a tough one. I could see, oh my god, why can't I think of his name? Andy Kaufman. I can see have been an alien, and then, you know, instead of dying, he is still alive, like everyone thinks, but he just went back to his planet.
Not fair. Fair. he's pissed off. That'd be fun. I think on my end, I would say Tom Kenny. I can see Tom Kenny.
Tom Kenny, yeah, you see him acting in some of those Mr. Show skits, and you're like, wow, you're like an incredible rubber man.
Yeah, like that's very, it's very much his like physicality that I've noted, and just like that, and just be able to like the voice, you know, work he's able to do. There's a certain, like you said, rubberiness to his presentation there. I'm like, yeah, I could see that. His bones aren't fully solid. I'd say that, and maybe like the Green Brothers, John and Hank Green, like just they're just like some benevolent species of just Renaissance men who decided to come down and be like, I want to just do some fun things and interact with these people. It's like, it's not meant to be like kind of in a negative sense, just the idea of like, you know what, yeah, this just seems like a fun thing to do. Meanwhile, they just, you know, John Green making companies every 10 minutes, as it apparently turns out. Apparently that's a running joke of he has made so many like companies and foundations at this point. It's apparently pretty crazy.
Jeez.
Yeah, like just all the different projects he and Hank get up to, and just all the stuff they talk about on a consistent basis. It's like, yeah, they are more than mere mortal men. It's like they are something. If they're not aliens, they're like a slightly more evolved version of humans. Because like, there's a show that Hannah and I watch, Dimension 20. I've told you about before. It's a D&D show. And Hank Green recently showed up in one of their like miniseries, and it is astonishing. There are a few people who have such on-screen charisma as Hank Green can have. Like, he can just, like, say a few words and just, like, immediately capture the room. It's like, my God. And, yeah, I could see that, like, yeah, he's either an alien or an evolved version of humanity, and I fully can believe that.
I could see that. You know, if we're talking, like, higher evolved beings, Amy Adams, too pure for this world.
Yeah, yeah, I'd say that's a good one. That's a very good one. too good. Ooh, Jack Nicholson. There's no way that motherfucker's human. There's no way.
Ever seen those interpretations of Martians from like Garrett P. Service etchings in the early 1900s where they have the giant heads and the tiny bodies?
I believe like so, weirdly enough.
Yeah, that's like a Nicholson.
Yeah, he is a Martian, like specifically Mars. Which, funny thing about considering he's in Mars Attacks.
Yeah,
I could see him fully as an alien.
Any others?
Oh, I mean, like, the running joke is Jack Black, but I actually think he might actually just be the purest form of humanity, and so everyone thinks he's an alien. I think he truly just is the most genetically perfect human being on Earth. It's like, yeah, this is the perfect template of a human in its prime.
Yeah.
I could fully see that.
I think I'd agree with that.
I have a similar thought of Tommy Wiseau. I believe he is actually the very first human Homo sapien to exist, and he is just accidentally immortal.
He's like a Vandal Savage?
Basically, but like less interesting.
He didn't actually do anything with his extra time.
Well, it's like, as it turns out, like, the earliest Homo sapien, the brain development wasn't really good enough to allow for, you know, truly, like, taking advantage of that whole scenario. It's just kind of just stayed odd all the way through.
Yeah, all these millennia, he's just been working up towards making the house that dripped blood on Alex.
Yeah.
That's all he was waiting to do.
Yeah, that was his It's... but yeah, I think... I can't necessarily think of anyone else specifically. I'm sure I'll come up with another one and just be like, we have to add this in afterwards. Yeah, I think those are the big ones. I think John and Hank Green being my firmest ones of... And again, it's that situation of, I don't want that to imply a negative sense, because, yeah, the both of them, obviously, I'm sure, like, have their own differences, like, in, like, I'm sure neither of them are neurotypical individuals, and I don't want that to be, like, a disparaging remark. If anything, it's kind of, if I think it's a praiseworthy thing in my mind. But again, even that's kind of can be a backhanded compliment. I just think they're just very interesting people, and I think they are outside of the typical human experience in a very positive way.
Fair. You put that together very well.
Thank God. Hank and John Green, I love you. Please don't hate me.
Well, we can move on to mine real quick, which, sure. It's funny because I plan mine ahead of time as well, which I usually tend to do. Yep. Mine are also just celebrity-based, but we've now gone through the gambit of the Men in Black franchise, which features Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones as sort of the partner duo, and then in Men in Black International, we got some Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson in there. So if we had another Men in Black reboot, who do you think would be the ideal pairing for that? If we can't go back to the well that we've already been using, who do you think would be the best duo to represent the Men in Black?
You know, I was about to say Jack Nicholson and Danny DeVito, but I realized that's just Hoffa, so I can't necessarily say that.
We're just taking Tim Burton Batman villains and we're putting them together?
No, I just, for whatever reason, I had it on my mind. I feel like they'd have a very chaotic and fun dichotomy between the two of them, but then I just remembered, you know, again, Hoffa, since they're both in that and they literally are partners in that. So I guess I can't, that one's kind of already taken. So, oh man, fucking B. Arthur and literally anyone.
Okay.
For a more specific one, oh Jesus, I would love to see, this might be a kind of a deeper cut one or just a weirder one, Christian Bale and Rob Schneider. I feel like they are two opposite ends of the acting spectrum, and I think them acting together might cause something to blow up.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's a...
I think Christian Bale's rage might reach nuclear levels when working alongside Rob Schneider, of all people. that's an odder one, I recognize, but I think that one would be hilarious.
No, I think that's interesting.
I'm sure I can think of more, but which ones are you thinking?
I had one. Nick Cage and John Lovitz.
Oh, yes.
I think would be an interesting pairing. I think they would, they're both different enough that they would get on each other's nerves constantly.
Mm. I can also see, weirdly enough, I can see Nick Cage and John Goodman. I think that would be funny.
John Goodman would be interesting. John Goodman and, maybe John Turturro? Get him in there?
Oh, yeah. Isn't that just... Oh, fuck. What's that movie that they're both in?
That's the Big Lebowski. That's the rivalry in the Big Lebowski.
Yes, that's it. Well, sorry.
No Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, I was like, what's the movie with both of them? It's the Big Lebowski. Jesus Christ. Jeff Bridges, it would be the villain. That'd be funny.
Yeah, he's in the Rip Torn role.
Yeah, exactly. That'd actually be pretty good.
For a more television-focused one, like if we want to, maybe we want to make the Men in Black be more like ABC... TGIF adjacent. God. We have like Steve Urkel and the baby from Dinosaurs. That'd be fun.
Oh dear God, the laugh I just made. This microphone doesn't pick up laughter super well, but I made a very, it was somehow both a deep but high-pitched chuckle. It was very unexpected.
I mean, I'm glad that you took to it. It probably wouldn't sustain a movie, but it would make a very interesting Burger King cup, I think.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's a good way to put it. I'm just trying to think of more outlandish ones to do now. Sonic from the Sonic animated cartoon, like the original one, and Steven Universe.
Oh yeah, that would be
no other reason other than I think that would just be the most obscene crossover to ever make, and I want to just see what comes out of that. Like the fact that Steven Universe has the alien thing going on already, and Sonic is just Sonic.
Oh, they'd say if every pork chop weren't perfect, we wouldn't have chili dogs. You see.
Again, the laugh I just made that did not get picked up by my fucking microphone. Oh, man, that was accidentally brilliant.
But no, that would be interesting, especially because Steven's half alien, you know.
Exactly, yeah. There's layers to this. There's an argument maybe Sonic is an alien here. Almost, well, I mean, technically he certainly is.
Oh, yeah, if he comes from that owl dimension.
But I'll say he comes from the dimension of that original animated cartoon where things are just like, there's just like shapes and shit in the sky.
Oh, yeah, the Felix the Cat inspired one.
Yeah, that one.
I like that one. That's the best Sonic cartoon.
I mean, if we're going with the live action version, I mean, I feel like it's staring us in the face of Sonic the Hedgehog plus Jim Carrey. Not Dr. Robotnik, Jim Carrey specifically.
Ace Ventura and the Mask.
Like just the mask, or like the character that Jim Carrey plays.
Yes, Stanley, whatever the fuck, has to be wearing it.
Okay, gotcha. I thought you just meant like you just give Ace Ventura the mask, which like no. I feel like that might cause an implosion of zaniness. It's like that might be too much.
Yeah,
I think that's
too much for me.
That's critical mass levels of 90s quirky. Oh man, I feel like I could do this for hours.
Yeah, I don't think I have any more. We gotta save it for next time.
Honestly, you know,
we're doing questions every time now.
If we can't think of a question for next time, we'll just keep this one going.
We'll just go back to the alien one.
Just like good pairings, like either what real life figure could you believe is an alien, or what two fictional or non-fictional characters could you see go together for a Men in Black team up?
We'll just update it every time we come back. It's like, oh yeah, time for another crack at this. Fuck, I don't know. Chris Farley and John Candy.
Dan Aykroyd's character in Ghostbusters and actual Dan Aykroyd.
I need to work with you to find aliens, but...
You tried my vodka?
I just... Yes.
There's so much... I feel like that would play off itself way better than it has any right to.
Yeah.
Oh man, this is... I'm getting more entertainment out of this than MIP International.
Oh man,
I feel like we've waffled hard enough here.
Yeah, I guess we can go ahead and go into socials.
Go right ahead. I'll think of more possible pairings for the ending.
Perfect. So go ahead and follow us, subscribe, like, favorite on all of your favorite podcasting platforms. We're on Apple Play, Spreaker, Podbay, Podomatic, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, YouTube, but we're hosted on Spotify for Podcasters. Go ahead and email us theyremadeit@gmail.com if you have thoughts on the episodes that we've been doing or the podcast in general, positive and or negative. You know, feedback is always appreciated. Or if you have ideas for episodes that we can do in the future, we always take those as well. Go ahead and follow us @itremade on Twitter for updates on when episodes are going live, potential episodes that we might cover in the future, posters and things discussing what we've been engaging with prior off of the show, things like movies we've been watching, shows, books we've been reading, games we've been playing, etc., etc., as well as full circle diagrams that I've been putting together regarding people that we've covered on the podcast more than once. And that is it for socials.
Fantastic. We always love to hear from you folks, for as often as it happens. Vincent Price and Kermit.
That is a very unique one. I you know what? I'm a fan.
Yeah, I was like,
what can I say?
I feel like Kermit with really anybody it almost feels like a gimme. So maybe Vincent Price with someone else.
Vincent Price and Eartha Kitt.
That just sounds like a fun road trip movie.
I'd watch that.
Keanu Reeves and a younger Keanu Reeves.
Oh, okay.
It's like,
I'm a fan.
There's not a whole lot there, but I feel like there'd be enough of a difference of John Wick versus, like, you know, Bill and Ted. You know what? Yeah, I'll scratch that. Whichever one he is in Bill and Ted, I believe it's Bill and John Wick.
Okay, perfect. my final contribution to this one will be Bruce Valanche and a KFC Double Down.
Okay, yep, I think I'm good to call it there.
All right, perfect.
I hate that laughs don't get picked up by this microphone. I would have blasted your ears with that laugh I just let out. Oh, man. As always, I am your host, Stuart.
And I'm your host, Jacob.
We think of these for the rest of the night and probably the next few weeks. So get ready for those.
in black. Remember that, just in case we ever face to face and make contact. The title held by me, MIB, means what you think you saw. You did not see.
Edwards, what the hell happened?
Hesitated.
May I ask why you felt little Tiffany deserved to die?
Well, she was the only one that actually seemed dangerous at the time, sir.
How'd you come to that conclusion?
Well, first I was going to pop this guy hanging from the streetlight, and then I realized, you know, he's just working out. And how would I feel if somebody come running in a gym, bust me in my ass while I'm on a treadmill? Then I saw this snarling beast guy, and I noticed he had a tissue in his hand. I realized, you know, he's not snarling. He's sneezing. You know, ain't no real threat there. Then I saw little Tiffany. I'm thinking, you know, 8-year-old white girl, middle of the ghetto, bunch of monsters, this time of night with quantum physics books. She about to start some head. She's about 8 years old. Those books are way too advanced for her. If you ask me, I say she's up to something. And to be honest, I'd appreciate it if you eased up off my back about it.